Now it's either send the emails to people who hear voices and people of the church, or nothing is going to happen. Why does he put so much pressure on me? Why can't he make his project happen? I have enough work to do just to keep us surviving. Affirmation to counteract the negative feelings I have inside. Number one, I am a creative, positive, successful, and happy person. Number two, I can achieve anything I set my mind on. Number three, we will succeed in everything we are trying to accomplish. Number four, I am a strong and capable person. Number five, we will succeed. Number six, I will have a strong and healthy body and mind. Number seven, anything and everything is possible with love. Number eight, our goals are attainable. Number nine, it's easy for me to get up every day and exercise. Number 10, it's easy for me to eat healthy. Number 11, I make it a habit to be happy. Number 12, I will be more assertive. Number 13, today is a glorious day. Number 14, every day I work towards my goals. Number 15, I make every day a positive day. Favorite quotes, May 1st, 2007. The world turns and the world changes, but one thing does not change. However you disguise it, this thing does not change. The perpetual struggle of good and evil. T.S. Eliot. What will happen will happen. There is time for miracles until there is no more time, but time has no end. Dean Koontz. Hope, love, and faith are all in the waiting. Dean Koontz. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing. T.S. Eliot. Places I will go one day. Number one, Egypt. Number two, Victoria Falls in Africa. Number three, Alaska, to see the Northern Lights. Number four, Norway, to see Aurora Borealis. Number five, Italy. Number six, Greece. Number seven, Ireland. Number eight, Galapagos Islands. Surviving. Pat has become very ill. Philip lets the girl stay in the house with her to keep her company. The other night, she fell, and the girls called Philip, and he called an ambulance. She was taken to the hospital and diagnosed with Parkinson's and low-grade dementia. Nancy, myself, and the girls are pitching in to take care of her, which is turning out to not be easy. She is losing her ability to walk and cannot go to the bathroom by herself. I am allowed in the main front house to take my shift with her. Nancy has started sleeping in the house to be near her at night, and the girls are sleeping in the blue building, which I have always called next door. I am sleeping in my tent out back. Every few years, I get a new tent because tents don't last forever. This one is going to last me a little longer than the others because a month prior to putting it up, Philip had built an elevated floor for it and it helps to keep it dry. Philip is sleeping in the house on the couch or in the spare room with Nancy. A new law has been enacted and he is being seen quite a bit by his parole officer. It makes it harder to go on outings now. A few months later, Philip suddenly informed us that he has another new parole officer and needs to report in. When his parole agent would come over in the beginning, Philip would tell us that we needed to stay in the back. Eventually, he started to get mad at the system and didn't care if we were in the house or not. He now lets the kids sleep in the house. One time, A parole agent paid a surprise visit on Philip and saw one of the girls sleeping in one of the spare rooms. I was told of this later by the girls because they were scared. Philip told me the next time a parole agent came to the house, I was to ask if he was the one that went into my daughter's room. After that, Philip was informed he was getting yet another new parole officer. One day, when I was in the house taking care of his mother, this new parole agent came and I asked if he was the agent who walked into my daughter's bedroom. He answered no, and I proceeded to wheel Pat back to her room. He took Philip's urine sample and left. More and more frequent visits are occurring at the house, and Philip is becoming more and more frustrated and paranoid. In his mind, he is doing nothing wrong. It's preventing him from doing this effectively with all the monitoring. He wants to get a lawyer and get off of parole. There is a washer and dryer in the house, but the dryer doesn't work, and neither does the washer. But we desperately need a washer. The printing business is not doing so well, and we don't have a lot of money, especially for going to the laundromat and washing clothes. Philip has finally fixed the washer. In order to use it, though, it has to be outside because the drainage in the house is not working. So we moved the washer outside. It was incredibly heavy and took all of our strength to move it out to the middle of the yard under a pine tree. Once he got it all hooked up, it was so nice being able to do the laundry and not waiting for it to pile up on us, especially since Pat has gotten sick and has had a lot of bedwetting and pooping accidents, and we have had to wash her sheets a lot. It seems like the house has started to fall apart since Pat got sick. Nancy found a huge water puddle in the middle of the house, and when Philip went under to check it out, discovered the pipes were rotting. The downstairs porch sink was always backed up with water, and Philip has showed us how to drain it with a siphon hose. It has to be done at least 3 times a day, or the sink tub will overflow, and then we'd have to clean up the floor. It's already happened a few times, and is a pain to soak up all the water on the floor. The water that backs up from the drain is black and gray. It's so disgusting. I hate the job of draining, but I hate my shift with his mom even more. She is getting really demented, and the only one she is nice to is her darling son, who could never do anything wrong. She says really mean things when I have to take her to the bathroom, or walk her, or exercise her. She hates everything except Philip. Nancy has a hard time with her too, but sometimes she can get her to listen. I feel like, deep down, she hates me though, and knows what I represent even though we have never told her. I think she knows I represent a side of her son that she doesn't want to acknowledge exists. Before she fell, I had only seen her a couple of times. She knew me as Alyssa, the sister of the girls that Nancy brought over from down the street, which was the story that Philip told her. Sometimes I think he would say, "These are your grandkids, too." I'm not sure what she thought. She didn't do much after she retired, just watched TV all day, and sometimes went shopping with her sister Celia, the one Philip gave my cat to. After Pat's fall, Celia died, and Nancy had to tell her. Some days she remembered, and others she didn't. The Parkinson's was eating her body, and the dementia was eating her mind. It's a sad thing. Maybe it's better that she will never truly know that her son did such an evil thing. Discovery and Reunion. On August 24th, Philip took the girls to the FBI office in San Francisco. He said that he liked to take the girls with him because he thought that people were more apt to listen when they were with him. I thought that at least it gave the girls a chance to get out of the house for a little bit. We had not been able to go anywhere during that year because we had to take care of Pat and she couldn't be left home alone for long. The advanced stages of Parkinson's and dementia were taking a toll on her. When Philip and the girls returned home later that afternoon, everything seemed normal. I asked how it went and if everything went the way he wanted it to. And he said he had met two cops from the Berkeley campus who were very interested in what he presented. He said, "They flipped," a term he used often when describing people's reactions, and were excited to hear more about his discovery, which was that others could hear him speaking with the power of his mind, with the aid of his black box. He also dropped off his documents entitled Schizophrenia Revealed to the FBI office in San Francisco that day, too. He said he was met with similar reactions. According to Philip, this was it, and he was finally going to be able to move forward with his God's Desire Church and fight for God. I really didn't think too much about what he said that day, because I had heard it countless times before. The truth is, I didn't want to think about it because I didn't want to be disappointed again. Time and again, he would tell me that we would finally get going and the kids could have a real tutor and we wouldn't have to work so hard just to get by. Deep down inside, I secretly held out the hope that someday, if he made it big, he would return me to my mom. So it was easier for me to just concentrate on the jobs I had to do and not ask too many questions. I learned not to ask too many questions to protect myself from constantly being disappointed with his answers that were always vague and repetitious. The next day, the 25th, I was in the backyard office, finishing up a print job that was due the next day. The girls were playing outside. Nancy was in the house taking care of Pat, and Philip was probably also in the house, either sleeping or reading the Bible. It was approximately 5 p.m. when all of a sudden, Nancy came running in to tell me Philip had been arrested. I was in shock. At first I thought she was just joking, but then I saw the worry on her face. I told her to calm down. Everything would be fine. Philip always said if anything ever happened that we just needed to get a lawyer. So I told her we should look in the Yellow Pages for a lawyer and a bail bondsman. I told her that Philip would use his one phone call to call us, and he would tell us what to do. I didn't want to alarm the girls and scare them. I had plenty of practice keeping calm and unaffected on the outside, when on the inside I felt anything but calm. Nancy and I told the girls, and they were scared. They had no idea why he had been arrested. None of us did at that point. Throughout the years, the girls and I grew up knowing Philip was on parole for hurting a woman, was sent to prison for many years, and that the parole agents that came to the house were there to supervise him, and that it was our job to keep the fact that we lived there a secret from the parole agents. So they knew that much. I had been hearing all about his prison experience for years from Philip. A few hours later, as we are all sitting in the house, trying to be calm and just wait for his call, in walks Philip and his parole agent through the back porch door. We were stunned and relieved. Philip was always the one with all the answers, and we didn't know what to do without him. Nancy ran to Philip and put her arms around him while shedding tears of stress and relief. The girls and I watched from the living room as his parole agent uncuffs him, instructs him to report the next morning to the Concord parole office, and leaves. After many hours of holding it together, I finally lost it and started to cry. It probably looked to everyone like I was relieved to have him back, but the truth is, on the inside, I feel like they were tears of anger. Yes, I was angry. Angry at everything. Angry at the parole agent for taking him and then not taking him. Angry at Philip for not doing anything to prevent all of this. We relied on him, and I guess in that instant it became clear how much we relied on him, and it didn't really look like he cared. It was all about the angels this and the angels that. What about us? It was always the same old thing with him. On some level, I wonder how he possibly could have come back. Perhaps it was true no one remembered me. I know it only fed Philip's delusions that he was somehow above the law. Philip believed that all the coincidences surrounding him from his kidnapping of me and getting away with it to present-day things, like his parole officer's inability to hold him for anything, were not just mere coincidence, but the work of the angels. His theory was that before he took me, he was developing the ability to hear the angels, and that in order to shut him up, they allowed him to get away with taking me, and thus kept him occupied and out of their realm. He thought there was no other way he could have possibly gotten away with his kidnapping that day, save for them. I had always believed in the good of angels, and this only further confused me. Was Philip truly special and in the eyes of God worthy of protecting, or merely making this whole story up to give himself an excuse? What about me? Wasn't I worth anything, or was I merely an object to use? For the most part, we were all relieved and went to bed thinking it was over. The next morning, as I was still sleeping in my tent, Philip comes out and tells me through the tent window that I need to get dressed because we are all going down to the parole office this morning. He said he was tired of this harassment from the authorities and wanted them to see that everything was okay so he could continue with his project mission. I was scared. I didn't know what to say. I got dressed and came inside to find the girls dressed and ready too. Before we left the property, Philip had me type up a letter for a lawyer that was based in Concord. He wanted to leave it with him on our way to the parole office, letting him know that his project was moving forward. He added that he would need this particular lawyer's services shortly. Pat was still asleep, so Philip thought she would be okay until we got back. I asked him what I should say when we get to the parole office. He said to say that I'm the girl's mother and that I gave him permission to have them with him, and that, yes, I was aware that he was a sex offender. If asked anything else, he said I should ask for a lawyer and say no more. We all got in the car, and he could see I was nervous. He said everything would be fine, and we'd get some breakfast on the way home. I couldn't say anything. I just shrugged my shoulders. On the inside, I was wondering what he thought he was doing. Did he really think we could just walk into the parole office and nothing would happen? But after years of being conditioned to listen to him on everything, it was easy to not say anything. Nancy didn't say anything the whole way up. The girls said everything would be okay. I was nervous that I would say the wrong thing and mess up whatever he had planned. All he kept telling me was not to be afraid, and if I was harassed, to ask for a lawyer right away. Philip always planned everything before he did it, so I assumed that he had thought this one out too. When we arrived at the Concord parole office, we all got out of the car. Philip marched us in the door of the parole office. I recognized Philip's parole officer coming towards us. Confusion registered on his face when he saw that Philip had brought minors into the office with him. He asked me, the girls, and Nancy to please come with him to the back. He said children were not permitted in the waiting room. As we were being led away from Philip, I remember looking back at him and asking with my eyes what to do. He winked at me. That was all. The parole agent led us into a private room and asked what we were doing here. I told him all the things that Philip told me to say. I gave him the name Alyssa because that was the name I had been using since the girls were born. It was the name that our clients knew me by. After he questioned mostly me for about 20 minutes, asking questions like who I was and what my purpose was for staying with the Garridos, he decided to let us go and gave me his card and told us we could leave. We went out the back way and sat in the car, willing Philip to walk out of the building so we could return home. I still could not fathom what the outcome of that day would turn out to be. Nancy was strangely quiet, and I asked her if I did okay with talking with the agent. She said I did really good, and she couldn't think of anything I could have added. She didn't understand why Philip had brought us all in the first place. Philip never walked down those steps. Instead, two parole agents came out, One was the one that questioned me, and he had a partner with him. When we saw them coming, I asked Nancy what she thought I should say or do. She said I could pretend to be a distant relative of Philip's mother from Missouri. When the two agents arrived at the car, they asked us to get out of the car. I looked at Nancy and asked her what we should do. She said she didn't know. While the new agent asked the girls and Nancy to sit on the curb, Philip's parole officer asked me to step away with him because he had a few questions for me. I felt like I was in big trouble. He said that I had been lying to him. He said that I was not the mother of these kids. I looked him in the eye and I stated, "I gave birth to both those girls, and that makes me their mother." He said Philip said that all three of us were actually his brother's kids. I didn't know what to say. I couldn't think of a reason why Philip would say such a thing after he had told me to tell everyone that I was the mother of the girls. I felt like he abandoned me. I started to think that I was in real danger of getting separated from my girls because this man did not believe me. He thought me a liar. I thought this man would take the kids from me if he thought I wasn't their mother. So I started to fight. And that's what I tried to do, even though I hated to tell this man lies. I did my best to convince him. I am not proud of that today. But I did what I had always done. Tried to survive an impossible situation. I told them that Philip was lying for me. That I was running from an abusive husband, and I didn't want anyone to know where I was. I went on and on and on. By this time, the kids were really scared. My youngest daughter had to go to the bathroom. The officer said to walk with him to the bathroom. We started walking, and I tried again to convince the officer to let us go. He said he had to call CPS, Child Protective Services. Philip spent years trying to convince me he was the one with all the power and answers. I was so scared, and even though I was so close to having my life back, I still could not crash through the wall that he built inside of me. A new female officer came, and the kids and Nancy were separated from me. In some strange way, it felt like I had become the suspect. I was alone in a room all by myself. I thought I would never see my kids again. The officer thought I had taken the kids and run away from somewhere. The officer said that if I didn't tell them my name and the truth, I would be taken down to the police station and fingerprinted, and then they would find out who I was. I didn't know what to do. I asked to see Philip. They brought him in handcuffs into the room I was in. I looked at him. I asked him in front of the officers what I should do. I told him they might take the girls away from me, and I couldn't let that happen. I didn't know what to do. He'd always been the one with all the answers. Now all he did was look at me with dead eyes and said I needed to get a lawyer. They took him away. After what seemed like another hour of me sitting in a room by myself, apparently giving me time to think about my situation, they sent a woman officer to come talk to me. During that time alone, I was beginning to realize that Philip was gone and that I was on my own and needed to take care of my girls. But I had been so conditioned to protect Philip and Nancy that telling a stranger my story was not easy for me, and I could not do it at first. I had asked for a lawyer several times, but the answer I kept getting was, "Why did I think I needed a lawyer if I said I didn't do anything wrong?" The woman officer was sympathetic and reassured me that my kids were okay and that I would see them again. I told her I didn't know what to do. She asked again for my name, and I told her I couldn't tell her. She told me everything happens for a reason and that everything was going to be okay. She left. I was alone again. She came back a while later. It felt like an eternity. I must have gone to the bathroom a million times. When she returns, She tells me Philip has confessed. She said, he confessed to kidnapping you several years ago. She asked me again for my name and how old I was when I was kidnapped. I felt like I had just been waiting for the right question, and I said I was 11 and that I was 29 now. She was shocked. She asked for my name again. I said I couldn't say it. I wasn't trying to be difficult. I told her I haven't said it in 18 years. I told her I would write it down. And that's what I did. Writing shakily on that small paper, the letters of my name. J.C. Lee Dugard. It was like breaking an evil spell. In that moment, I felt free, but also exhausted and completely alive all at the same time. Talk about an emotional roller coaster. I wrote down my name for the first time in 18 years. She also had me write down my date of birth and my mother's name. I looked at her and I said, I can see my mom? She said, yes. After they had my name and realized who I was, they quickly reunited me with my girls. I was so relieved. Plans were made to take me and the girls over to the Concord police station, where everyone thought we'd be more comfortable. At the police station, I was given a room to wait in while the girls were entertained in the front office. I guess they felt like I needed some time by myself. During this time, I was visited by many people, including the female officer that I had given my name to. I didn't know why I was waiting in that room. I was asked for my story a few times, and I recounted as much as I could in all instances. During one of these visits, I met officers Todd and Beth. They came to introduce themselves and asked if there's anything I needed. At first I said no, but then I reconsidered because I could hear G in the other room talking to anyone that would listen about how worried she was about her hermit crabs back at the house. I asked Officer Todd if it was possible to get the hermit crabs from the house and let her have them, and he said he would see what he could do. I was also very concerned about our cats and the two dogs I had been taking care of for our neighbor. The two officers said they would try to get some answers for me. Alone again, the tears I had been holding back finally came pouring out, no longer waiting for permission to fall. At one point, as I was sitting in the room by myself, the lights mysteriously turned off, and I was plunged in instant blackness. For some reason, my mind thought that the authorities were trying to scare me into telling them something else, but I didn't know what. I sat there in the dark for a second and said aloud in the dark, "Hello?" Nothing happened. So I finally moved and the light popped on, and I realized that I had been sitting in the same place for so long and not moving that the light sensor thought the room was empty. I felt kind of stupid and got up to go to the bathroom, just so I didn't have to sit in that room by myself anymore. I remember I had to convince myself to get up and ask to go to the bathroom. No one had told me that I could leave the room, and I had been conditioned to wait for permission. But in that moment, I had an overwhelming need to get out of that room, if even for a few minutes. Next step involved me, a phone, and two officers from the El Dorado County Sheriff's Office. It was the much-anticipated phone call to my mom. I was really running on adrenaline by then. I couldn't eat the food that was offered. I think I had taken a sip of Dr. Pepper. My stomach was tied up in knots. The officers first asked if I had any questions about anything, and the question that popped into my mind and I asked was, "Is my mom still with my stepfather, Carl?" I was informed that my mom and Carl had been separated for years and no longer lived together. I was relieved because I had been anxious about going back to the house with Carl there. I had come to resent him for always trying to separate me and my mom when I still had time with her. In the room with the two officers and the phone sitting on the desk, all I could think of was, Mom. That one word was swimming round and round in my head. I had so much I wanted to say. But as I sat there, listening as the phone rang, it felt like my tongue weighed 1,000 pounds. The first call was placed to her house. The phone rang and rang, and just when they were prepared to cut the connection and try a different number, the phone picked up and a female voice answered, Hello? The officers ask for my mom, and it sounds like the voice on the other end says she is at work and can be reached there. The officer asked if this was her daughter, and when they get the answer, yes, they proceed to tell her the reason for calling. I'm sitting there listening, thinking that I cannot believe they are talking to my baby sister. There were times in the backyard that the people I loved took on an almost dreamlike state and became not real but imaginary people from my past. The officers concluded the call by saying that they would be in touch again as soon as they got hold of our mom and hung up the phone. The next call they placed was to my mom's workplace in an attempt to contact her. This time, they were put through to her, and by the time I heard her voice on the other line, I was at a complete loss for words. I don't even remember what I said. I've asked my mom since, and she told me that I said I had babies. I can't believe I said that. I meant something completely different. Not that my kids were babies, but I just wanted her to know I wasn't alone and that I came with kids. And in a way, that was my attempt to see if she would accept them with me. I knew I would never leave my kids, and if my mom rejected them for some reason, I didn't know what I would do. I wanted her desperately, but I was also a mother with a responsibility to my girls. Luckily, that turned out not to even be an issue, and we were all accepted with open arms. I believe I also got out the words, "Come quick!" I remember hearing her screaming on the other end that, "My daughter has been found!" over and over, and then I said, "I love you." And that's all I remember from the initial call to my mom. I wish I could remember every moment, but my mind was on overload. Officer Todd arranged for the three of us to stay at a hotel that night, and as we left the CPD, we drove past a news van and barely missed being discovered. When we arrived at the hotel, Todd's partner Beth, who we had also met at the CPD, brought us some pajamas and toiletries. Todd pulled me aside and mentioned that the girls weren't eating because I wasn't eating and that if I ate, it would help them. So I announced I was hungry and we decided on enchiladas for dinner. I could only force down a couple of bites, but at least it was something. And the girls ate. We were left alone together for the first time all day, and I was encouraged to tell the girls what was happening and why. I tried to explain everything to them in a way I thought would be right. As we sat on the bed together that night, and I recounted to them all that their dad was responsible for, they were surprisingly open to all that I said and didn't really seem surprised to hear any of it. I told them that the days ahead would be tough on both of them and me too, but that I would do all I could to make the right decisions for our future, and no matter what, we would be together. I told them I would never leave them. A knock on the door brought more people to meet. These two being victim advocates assigned to me and my daughters. After introductions, we were left to our own privacy again. I was nervous about the reunion the next day with my mom and sister, who I was desperate to meet. The girls were very supportive and excited for me. They slept in one bed together, leaving me to toss and turn in the other bed. I don't think I slept more than a few minutes that night. I had a terrible sinus headache from crying for several hours. Questions like, what if my mom doesn't accept the girls? What if my mom hates me? What if my mom is still with Carl? Could I have tried harder to leave? That night, many thoughts and fears and guilty feelings regarding Philip and Nancy tried their best to implant themselves in my head, and it left me feeling exhausted by the morning. My world had turned upside down, and I didn't know what to do. I had fears for my daughters. Would I be able to protect them in the outside world? I always had Philip to protect them for me when we went out, and all of a sudden, it was just me. Everyone that I had encountered had been so nice, and I felt protected with them, but I had a fear it would end soon, and I'd be alone. The next day finally came after a long and restless night. I was so nervous my stomach was full of butterflies. Would I recognize her? Would she remember me? Would she like the person I had become? Would she be mad at me? Would she accept my girls as her grandkids? I had so many questions and thoughts. Too many for my mind to process. When I was told that my sister and my aunt had come with my mom, I was so excited and nervous that I had to remind myself to breathe. Every time someone would say the word mom, I would burst out crying. The FBI agents that had been brought in said they were going to brief her, and then I would be able to see her. The briefing seemed to take forever, but the time finally came. With a last encouraging hug from each of the girls, I followed one of the many people to the elevator. Prior to that, I was asked if I prefer to meet my mom alone initially, and I said that I would like that, and to please bring the girls in later. Once downstairs, I was escorted to the door of the room she was in. I'm not sure if I truly believed that my mom was in the room waiting for me. I was convinced that this day would never happen. On the threshold of the room, I was frozen for a minute. I couldn't move. I just stared wide-eyed at the door. Finally, I took a deep breath and made myself walk through the door. And there she was! I knew it was her instantly. For the longest time, I couldn't remember what she looked like. I would try to draw her, but her face wouldn't come to mind. Sometimes, different aspects of each of my daughters reminded me so much of my mom, but I couldn't pinpoint exactly what it was because I had forgotten what she looked like. But there she stood, with arms wide open. I walked to her, and she was smiling and crying, and she put her arms around me, and I felt so safe and whole again. Even now, just writing about it brings tears to my eyes. I told her she smelled the same. She said it was smoke. But it was more than that. I remembered her scent, like I remembered from when I was young. It was the same. She was my mom, and she was holding me. The whole experience felt surreal. As we stood there crying on each other's shoulders, she pulled back a little to look me in the eye and hold on to my shoulders. She said to me, "I knew I would see you again. Do you remember when we used to sit outside on the porch swing and talk about the moon as it rose high in the sky? Well, when you were taken from me, I used the moon to talk to you. I've been talking to you for so long. The other night, the moon was full and bright, and I asked the moon, 'Okay, where are you, Jace?' The next day, I get the call that you have been found." I look at her astonished. I tell her, "I remember that moon, too. I was walking out to my tent, and for some reason, I looked up and stared at the moon for a few minutes. It seemed strange to me at the time, because I usually avoided looking at the moon. I tell her that it was too painful because it brought back memories of her. but that moon was so bright it caught my eye. Now I'm here with you. We hug some more, and then sit down to catch up on our many years apart. Firsts for me. My life has changed so much since that summer. I am free to be a mother to my girls. I am free to drive. I am free to say I have a family. My family is my own. I have my daughters, my mom, my sister, and my aunt. I am rebuilding relationships with my extended family and friends. I have met so many new people. It's amazing to know so many people and to count some of them as my close friends. For so long, I was confined to knowing just a few people. When I was in captivity, there were times that I longed to talk to the girl at the cash register, if only about the weather. But Nancy was always there with me, and I know it would have gotten back to Philip. And then, the lecture would ensue. I've learned that verbal abuse can be just as damaging as physical abuse, and take longer to heal from. But I'm doing that as well. I'm healing from the physical and verbal abuse I endured for so long. It has not been an easy road. I got lucky, though, by being placed with a psychologist who has a unique approach to traditional therapy. And I believe she is a big part of why I'm making as much progress as I am. With her help, I am learning to speak up for myself, something that if I did before, was always met with opposition and Philip telling me why I was wrong. It's hard to stand up for yourself when all the other person does is tell you how wrong you are and give you reasons why he is right. I'm now able to make decisions for myself and my girls. And although they have not always been the right choices, they were still mine to make, and that feels good despite the bad decisions. One example of this is going to Sly Park with my daughters for a friend's birthday campout. I wanted to go, but was warned about the dangers of the paparazzi and snapping some pictures. I am headstrong, and I wanted my girls to be able to see the Perseid meteor shower in the darkness of a campsite. So I chose to take them. We had a fabulous time camping out under the stars. We laid our blankets and sleeping bags and watched as the flashes of light darted across the sky. We also played in the lake and ate pie for dinner and hamburgers for dessert. We had a great time together and didn't realize our privacy was being violated. Upon returning home and learning of the pictures that were taken that weekend, I was immediately saddened and embarrassed. I also felt horrible that I had inadvertently put my girls in the public eye again. What was supposed to be a fun trip before school started turned into a nightmare. Thank goodness for my public relations manager. She was able to get the girls' faces blurred in the tabloid pictures, saving them from unwanted attention. All I want is for my girls to have the privacy and freedom they deserve in the days ahead. And thanks to her, we can have that a while longer. Another emotion I felt during that ordeal was doubt in myself. I felt I could no longer be trusted to make sound decisions. I felt that because I had made the decision and it turned out to be the wrong choice, then all my future choices would be no good too. It took a few sessions with my therapist to get me to see that it was okay to make the decision I did, that it was better that I went, despite some advice that it could be dangerous because it was a public place. Because if I had not gone and heeded the advice I was given, I would never have truly known if it was safe or not to go and would have resented the advice. So it was better to have made the decision I did and learn from it. Also, not all choices are black and white. We all have the right to make up our own minds about stuff, but it's better when you have all the facts and go in to make an informed decision. Looking back, I should have researched where Sly Park was and asked some questions about how public it was before I made the decision to go. Milestones. Even though I was closed off to the outside world in the backyard, the outside world did find a way to touch us. I remember 9/11, the day the terrorists flew planes into the Twin Towers, killing all those people. I remember exactly where I was when Philip came running outside to tell me. He yelled in his sad voice, "Alyssa, did you hear? Someone just crashed a plane into one of the Twin Towers." I was outside going pee in my pee hole. My outdoor toilet was full, and Philip didn't like to empty it very often. I made myself a pee hole outside, so I was out there when I heard the news. I rushed back in the studio, and the news was on Channel 3. They were showing pictures of the building smoking and the helicopter circling. It was so scary. I kept on thinking, I wonder what else they were going to bomb. And who had done it? Then the news reporter started talking about all the people that were trapped inside, and I started crying. Philip and Nancy were crying too. Philip said the angels made the terrorists do what they did, and that's why he had to expose the angels to the world one day. It made more sense than anything else in the world did at that time. Other than 9/11, there were no real events in my life to recall. I didn't really have any of the typical milestones that other kids enjoy, like first crush, first date, or getting my driver's license. I think I was 21 or 22, and I had gone with Philip for the drive to the paper place, where we got our paper for the printing business in Concord. We got stuck in traffic coming home. Traffic always makes me feel sick. I felt like I was going to throw up, so he pulled over for a minute. He said it was too bad I was sick, because he was going to teach me how to drive that day. I was feeling too sick to say anything, so I just shrugged. On the inside, I was so disappointed. I wonder if he was really going to teach me to drive that day. I always wanted to learn how to drive. My girls always thought it was weird that I didn't know how to drive yet. They would ask me why, and I would say because I didn't want to, and maybe one day I would. What else could I say? They asked their dad too, but he would say something like, "Alyssa will be able to learn how to drive one day, and I am really looking forward to that day." Again, I would wonder when that day would ever come. One time, I was out shopping with Nancy, and she said, "Why don't you sit in the driver's seat and give it a try?" I was a little scared. I was probably 25 or 26 at the time and had never even sat in the driver's seat before. It was a foreign concept to me, even though I longed to be able to drive. I did get in the driver's seat, and she said to start it up, and I did. But I guess I hit the accelerator a little too hard and almost backed into the truck that was coming in behind us. Nancy got a little freaked out, and that was the last time she let me try. So I didn't learn to drive until I was 29 and out in the real world. I can't say I remember turning 16. I was already a mom. I also never got the chance to graduate from high school, although I do hope to earn my GED one day. I do remember, however, when my sister Shayna turned 16. I was 26, and by then, living in Philip's secret backyard in my own tent. I loved the freedom of having my own room. When the printing business was making good money, Philip would give me and Nancy an allowance to spend. I bought roses to put around my tent and used the bamboo growing in the back to make my own fence surrounding my room. I planted morning glories, purple ones, and they grew up to engulf my makeshift fence of bamboo. I made a walking path of stones to the front of my room, so when it rained, I wouldn't get sand in there. I had my own things, and Nancy and I would go thrift store shopping for clothes, knickknacks, and shoes. I remember waking up on January 16th, 2006, and the very first thing I did that morning was say out loud to no one in particular, because I was all by myself out there. I said, "Happy 16th birthday, Shayna!" I really wished I could be there to celebrate with her on that day. I wondered what she looked like and if she was happy. I wonder if she had a sweet 16 birthday party. I so wanted to be with her on that day. That's all I could think about all day for some reason. Philip Garrido took many things from me, and watching my sister grow up was one of them. I have loved my sister since the day she was born, and dreamed about one day being her best friend. I was always a shy kid, and she represented a 24-hour companion for me. Although it was hard sometimes to watch how Carl loved her more than me, that didn't change my feelings towards her. I have never really thought of her as my half-sister. She's always just been my little sis. I wanted so much to do things with her. Like, I couldn't wait for her to get older, so we could ride the bus together. I would see the other girls with their sisters and couldn't wait for the day when I could introduce my little sister to them. Or if my sister was being picked on, as her older sister, I could come to the rescue and chase away all the bullies. I had so many plans for us, but all of it was stolen away. When I saw my now grown-up little sister for the first time at age 19, I was amazed. She was so beautiful and tall. She was wearing white that day. My first thought was, I wonder if she's a nurse. But I learned later she wasn't. She was still in college and trying to decide what she wants to be in this world. I think she should take all the time she needs to figure that out. She's very smart and perceptive. It has been hard getting to know her. I have been so busy with my own kids, and she has a life of her own. From her perspective, she was a baby when Philip took me from our family. She never knew me. She grew up hearing about her sister JC that was kidnapped when she was 11 years old, but she didn't remember me. On the other hand, I remember her, and I remember playing with her as a baby. I just didn't know the person she grew up to be. We have plenty of time to build a lasting friendship. The base is already there, which is our deep love for one another. The rest will come with time. My sister Shayna actually taught me to drive. How ironic is that? My little sister teaching me, her big sister, by 10 years, to drive. It was great, though. She was the first one to say, "Come on, let's go for a drive." And she was an awesome teacher. She was very relaxed and calm. I was shaking and scared to death the first time I got into my mom's car. Yes, I used my mom's car. I was giddy with joy, and adrenaline was pumping through my veins. I was ecstatic. I learned to drive on a very winding lane. I think in the long run, that was a great experience for me. After I received my driver's license, thanks to the generosity of a complete stranger, I was given the incredible gift of a brand new car. To me, my car is much more than just a car. To me, it represents my newfound freedom. I can now take my girls places and go where I want to go anytime. By the time I got my license, I wasn't the best driver, but I was a very cautious driver. Still am. In fact, my mom teases me about my two hands on the wheel and looking straight ahead driving style. But I like to be cautious and careful. Driving is becoming much more comfortable for me now, and I feel like I could drive just about anywhere, which is so cool. I am now driving my kids back and forth to school every day. How amazing is that? Who would have thought I would be actually driving my girls to school and packing their lunches and being able to take a walk with them whenever we want? It just really amazes me that I am now free. The difficult parts of life. Do you ever think twice before going to your child's football or basketball game? Do you ever have to think, am I putting my kid's future in jeopardy because I show up at a game? I have to think about that every time I step out of the house. Am I doing something today with my kids to cause them to get their photo taken and possibly jeopardize their privacy? I know this is not a life or death situation, but it's hard for me nonetheless. Now that I can, I want to be there for them in all the ways I couldn't before. Watch them play ball and help them with school functions. But I can't without risking someone will recognize me and connect me with them. Sometimes I feel like I'm still a prisoner. Yes, I could decide to screw it and to hell with what happens. But I really don't have that choice. It is a free country, and as such, people have the right to take your picture or your kid's picture and sell it for the highest price. I spent 18 years hiding and not being seen. And now, it almost feels like history is repeating itself. I know that sounds dramatic, and maybe it is, but it kills me inside to tell my daughters we can't do something together, because I can't risk them being connected with me. I know it's not the end of the world. I will get through this. It will be an exercise of saying no, putting my foot down, and saying it's just too risky. Something so simple. People watch their children's games, go to the school fair, host a spaghetti feed, and don't even think twice. Some may grumble and rather be in my shoes, and some just take it as a normal duty as a parent. I feel I have missed out on so many things already that I hate to miss a second more. But I have to keep my girls safe and their lives normal. Sometimes I have trouble untangling my past and my present. My past was spent hiding and feeling nervous when I was out in public. I had been conditioned to blend in and not draw attention, change my hair color, wear a wig, put on glasses, and wear a hat. Now it is mostly the same. Inside, I fight a war about being the person I want to be and tempering that with who I need to be to keep my kids safe. When will the battle end? Finding old friends. Officer Todd and a friend were able to sneak my daughter's hermit crabs into the hotel room while we were there. Todd contacted a fellow officer that was assigned to the search of the property and told them where to find them. That officer found the hermit crabs and brought the tank back to the station. The next day, Todd and his friend smuggled them into the hotel. They walked it past the front desk using a luggage carrier with towels covering the 10-gallon tank. Then up the elevator they went. When they knocked on the door, the room was already filled with people, from FBI to police to victim advocates. The room barely had standing room. People had to make way as Todd and his friend rolled the precious cargo inside the room. G was sitting on the bed, and as Todd lifted the towel off the tank, the biggest smile I had seen in a long time spread across her face. G dubbed Officer Todd Royal Crab Carrier 1 and Todd's friend Royal Crab Carrier 2, right there on the spot. Officer Beth was able to keep track of our cats and the neighbors' dogs for us, too. The animal shelter the cats were at spayed and neutered them for us and gave them all their shots. There were 6 cats rescued from the property altogether, 4 of our new kittens and 2 adult cats, Patches and Lily, who were strays that I had fed. Beth asked what I wanted to do about the 2 dogs. And since I never really felt they were mine, I asked if she could find good homes for them, which I later found out she did. Patches turned out to have nose cancer, and the animal shelter volunteered treatment for him. I was torn at the prospect of never seeing any of them again. But I also knew I had no home, no money, and I had no idea what our future held. The girls were adamant they wanted to at least keep the kittens. I asked Beth if she could find foster families for our cats until we were more settled, and she said, no problem. We were reunited with our kittens January of 2010. Beth adopted Patches, who has since survived the nose cancer and who has found his family. Lily was adopted by a friend of Beth's and is living a happy, carefree life. My oldest daughter's parakeet was returned to her, and she has had him ever since. Beth also told me the ambulance had come for Philip's mother, and she was being cared for. After my initial shock at being reunited with my mom, sister, and aunt, I began to wonder what happened to my best friends, Jesse and Shawnee. Jesse had been such a constant of my early years that a part of me never forgot about her, and I thought of her often. Shawnee was the last friend I had, and I was curious as to how her life was now. I enlisted the help of my new friend, Todd. A few weeks after our recovery, Todd asked me if there were any friends I would like him to find, and I said I would like to find Jesse and Shawnee. He had no trouble finding Shawnee on Facebook, and soon told me that she was married with a couple of kids. He said he had contacted her on Facebook and left a number for her to call. I guess she was a little suspicious of that, because she had her lawyer call and check him out first. But when she found out that he was indeed a real officer and was calling on my behalf, she accepted. To keep my privacy, Shawnee began sending letters to Officer Todd in care of the police station, and he would get the letters to me. The letters eventually turned into emails that he would forward to me. It was wonderful to reconnect with her and hear that she was happy with her two kids and married to a wonderful guy. I learned that she had lost her grandma Millie, who I remember her living with in Tahoe, and she had also lost her mom a few years back. But she made a wonderful life for herself, and I am so happy for her. I called her on the phone for the first time on November 5th, 2009. I invited her to my daughter's birthday. She couldn't come down at the time because she also had a couple of birthdays to celebrate. And so we made plans for her to come down and visit in December. When I saw her for the first time, she looked so much the same, I would have recognized her anywhere. She had a huge surprise for me and my family. Her work had pulled together and brought us things we desperately needed. Christmas came early for us all. Todd and his family were there too, and he brought us each a brand new bike. It was the best Christmas ever. But it wasn't the presents that made it special. It was being able to see my mom smile and happy, and seeing that my sister turned into a beautiful woman, and knowing my aunt never forgot me. Knowing I had a family was the biggest and best gift of all. Todd also found my childhood friend Jessie. She was a little more difficult to find, but he eventually did. She wrote me letters and sent me homemade chocolate chip cookies through Todd, and then we started to email. I called her for the first time on November 5th, too, after I got done talking with Shawnee. Did I mention how nervous I was to call either one of them? Even though they had been sending me letters and seemed to remember me, I was still nervous to call either one of them. Todd assured me that they both wanted to talk to me, but still, what if I didn't know what to say? I still didn't feel comfortable using the phone without permission. It's taking some time to realize I don't have to ask permission to do things I want. I was shaking as I dialed each of their numbers. They both turned out to be very easy to talk to. The call to Jesse lasted an hour and a half. She did most of the talking, but I loved to listen to her talk and tell me about her life. I invited her to come up for G's birthday, and she started crying and said she would be there. Jesse drove 9 hours to get to us and brought her 7-year-old daughter and her mom. As she drove up the driveway, she was so excited she barely put the car in park before she jumped out and ran to me and embraced me in the fiercest hug I had ever had. We were both crying, and in that moment I felt an old connection reestablish. It's an odd feeling to know that a certain person will always be there for you, no matter what. It's hard to describe. My friend was the old Jesse and the new combined. She was taller than me, which bugged me because growing up, I had always been taller than her. She still had the same long dark brown hair, and she was skinny, just like before. She looked so much like her mom. After we let go of each other, she introduced me to her daughter, and I introduced my 2 daughters. My mom and sister were there too, and we were all hugging each other. Hugging Jesse's mom again was a wonderful feeling too. Growing up, I had spent a lot of time with her, and hugging her was like going back in time and smelling the salty sea air where she used to take us and tasting the sand in our sandwiches as we sat on the warm beach in Southern California. We talked until the wee hours of the night. It felt so natural and easy. The next day, they all helped decorate for G's birthday party. We had invited all our new friends, including Todd and his family and Beth. It was crab-themed because my daughter loves her hermit crabs, Kevin, Devin, and Cheese. Therapeutic healing. Initially, I assumed that I would be going home with my mom once we were released. I didn't know what to think of this prospect. Honestly, I was doing what I had always done and was just going with the flow. I had absolutely nothing but the clothes I was wearing, my girls, and $500 that Todd gave me from one of his family members. So I had a total of $500 to my name. My initial reaction to this money was disbelief that a perfect stranger would give me so much. My thought was, why would a perfect stranger want to help me? Officer Todd replied, "People just want to help you. There will be many more." Officer Beth got us toiletries and pajamas the first night of our release, which I was very grateful for. I was scared of everything, to say the least. But deep inside, something that had been dormant for so long was finally getting the chance to grow, and I felt it glowing inside of me. A light that I thought had been extinguished was slowly coming back to life. Every time things seemed overwhelming, I would look at my mom, and that happy feeling came back, and the warm light inside grew bigger. I was told there was a reunification specialist located a couple hours away from the hotel we were staying at, who was willing to work with me and my family. I wasn't sure what to say about this offer. Traditional therapy did not appeal to me. The therapy I kept envisioning consisted of me in a small room and someone I didn't know, which was the last thing I wanted. I felt I had worked through what had happened to me, and I had always kept my own counsel and thought I was my own best therapist. I didn't want to meet another stranger. In the day and a half, I had met so many new people that I was really overwhelmed. Ultimately, what convinced me to seek the help of this person was the mention of horses. The impression I got of this person was that of an older lady with a ranch and horses and plenty of room for us to come and get our feet on the ground for a few days. She was one of a few professionals specializing in the field of reunification in abduction cases. I have to confess that part of me wanted to do something for my oldest daughter that Philip had always promised her he would do and never followed through on. and that was arranging horseback riding lessons. I figured